Good evening, everyone. Welcome to main stage number 2 at the very wonderful MDYP. How about a round of applause for this beautiful place and its great staff? Yeah. Of course, I'm still just sucking up, right? It's just Tuesday, and I want them to continue to love us for many days and maybe even many years. My name is Charlene Deal, and I'm the director of the Winnipeg International Writers Festival, and we are a third of the way through Thin Air 2019. We're having a spectacular time. We've met amazing writers and delightful readers, and my little team and the big posse of volunteers has been lifting and moving and smiling and making everything easy. So it's been a really amazing few days, and we are excited for many more. I'd like to begin by acknowledging our sponsor for this evening, which is Friesens, who prints pretty much every book that matters, right? And they also are a very strong sponsor for us and help us with the cost of printing those funky little purple programs. So here's a hand for Friesens Printing. And I'll point out the other folks who are represented on this stage. One is the wonderful bookstore McNally Robinson, where many of those Friesens printed books are residing and waiting for you to please come up and open your wallet. McNally's has been our festival bookseller since the start and are a really important part of our life, as they are part of the life of all the readers in this city. So how about a round of applause for them as well? And if you were here last night, you've already looked at this spectacular furniture suite from Hut K. The furniture models change each night, which I think is kind of a great idea, so you can see how many different kinds of people look great on this furniture. You can't take the people, and you actually can't take the furniture without paying for it, but it's really gorgeous. So we're really glad that Hut K provides this great set for us. You guys do look really good there. Yeah. Beautiful. I'd like you to take a second to turn off your cell phones, if you would, or at least put them on silent. You might want to take some great photos of the, you know, the furniture models. And we have a hashtag, ThinAir2019, if you want to get some action on social media. We're always happy about that. Before we begin to hear the amazing words this evening, I'd like to acknowledge that we're gathered on Treaty 1 territory. This is traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. It's a special time for us to gather together and share one another's stories and listen hard for all of the stories that are hiding and that are just gradually finding their way out into the open as we all learn to be better neighbors. So I'm grateful to be here, and I know that we all are. I know I'm not supposed to play favorites because it's sort of like choosing your favorite kid, you know? It's like really not a good idea. But I really love the poetry evening. I think it's poetry is a very difficult art form. It's a very magical art form, and it's perfectly, perfectly built for an evening of speaking and listening. So I always look forward to the magic that happens when poets come to the podium. And we have an amazing lineup tonight. And we're going to open with Winnipeg's very first poet laureate, an award-winning poet, and a woman who's really done amazing things in these 2 years of her in her role as the poet laureate of Winnipeg. So will you please welcome Di Brandt.
Well, and I think we should give a special hand to Charlene Deal and the Thin Air team for bringing us another spectacular festival. We're happy to, we're lucky to have such a smart and dedicated team of organizers working year-round to bring us this feast of literary riches. And it's so nice to have such a strong spotlight on poetry as well, so let's give them a hand. I'm just going to say a few words about the Poet Laureate appointment. Many people come up to me and ask me, what is a Poet Laureate and what does a Poet Laureate do? So I thought I would tell you a little bit about this Poet Laureate position and what this Poet Laureate is doing. So I thank Mayor Brian Bowman and the City of Winnipeg for sponsoring the Poet Laureate program here. And it's been an honor to represent the city poetically as the first poet laureate of this city. And I couldn't have wished for a better supporting team than the lovely, talented staff at the Winnipeg Arts Council, whose project this is. This is my second and final year as the Winnipeg Poet Laureate, so next year we will be welcoming a different poet in this role. There's the possibility of building a really valuable city tradition and archive here. And I thank Thin Air and other Winnipeg organizations for generously hosting Poet Laureate-related features and events to set us off in this direction. So I'm just going to name a few of those. McNally Robinson Bookstore hosted our multi-language World Poetry Day event in March, featuring more than a dozen languages and poetries from around the world, spoken by citizens from all walks of life, ranging in age from 8 to 80. And involving many cultural centers in Winnipeg. Many people had never been asked to give a public presentation in their heritage language, and it was a very moving event. The Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra has commissioned me as Poet Laureate to write a poem for the upcoming transatlantic tour to the Netherlands in the spring of 2020. And Prairie Fire Magazine has a lovely Poet Laureate feature forthcoming in the September issue. The Winnipeg Free Press has offered me a poetic guest column in the newspaper, so look for out for that every second Saturday this fall. I always wanted to figure out how to write for the newspaper, so I think this is a really cool way to get into the newspaper. The University of Winnipeg will be hosting a gala outgoing poetry music recital at the Eckhart Gramaté Hall on Monday, November the 25th. Featuring new musical settings of my poetry by Canadian posers David Lidov, Yana Skuretsky, Ken Nichols, and others, and featuring such prestigious and fine guest artists as Tracy Dahl, Rosemary Vanderhooft, Richard Turner, Micah Heilbrunn, Mel Brown, and the Des Hôtels Chorale. We expect the new Poet Laureate for 2020 and 2021 will be announced and introduced at that event, so hope to see you all there. And another project in process is a series of poetry installations featuring Winnipeg poetry in prominent public places being created with the Winnipeg Arts Council Public Art Program. So watch out for that. And if you'd like to read the poems I wrote and presented at the Mayor's Luncheon for the Arts and City Hall and last year's Thin Air Festival, in case you missed them at the time or would like to enjoy them again, you may find them on the Winnipeg Arts Council website. And now to the moment at hand. I was reading some of popular science writer and biologist Stephen Jay Gould's essays recently, an entertaining writer that he is. I couldn't help quarreling with him in my mind about his understanding of, well, everything, his theory of everything, especially. I'm just preaching to the choir, I know, but think that deep thoughts are still most comfortably the domain of the poetic. I'm sure you all agree. This is called Gang Wars in the Hood, or Notes from North Point Douglas. And it's with a nod to William Blake's visionary introduction to the Songs of Experience. A lot of gang wars in the hood this summer. Blood on the sidewalk most mornings. Beaks and claws and bits of bone, the furred and feathered, the transparent winged, the thin-skinned, the fluttery and slithery, chasing each other joyfully and with menace up and down the rough-barked trees, the gardens, the sidewalks, and the grassy boulevards. And the noise, by God, the cawing, barking, mewing, honking, buzzing, growling, worrying, the sudden chirp of a lone, lost grasshopper next to a stately parade of ants across the street, proudly carrying dead wasps five times their size home to their young. Everyone busy finding food and beating off intruders from their tender nests or just having fun. The ferocious flap of crow's wings over the marauding squirrels, the skillful knot, flutter, host, quarrel, crew of sparrows against the crows. It's a wonder, with all these gang wars going on, the ugly little babies with their sealed eyes and awkward limbs and mewling, squealing mouths ever make it out of their nest for their own short season in the sun. And in the midst of it all, there's you with your morning coffee and the cat's furry paws and sharp-tuned ears and noses a-quiver, crouched under the swaying elms for a quick ambush of a sparrow or squirrel. Yes, you too, human, sipping your delicious hot coffee and cream on the back steps, watching the sunrise. Yesterday's garden dirt still black under your fingernails. You too are a member of this amazing planetary philharmonic choir, singing, nesting, chasing, attacking, crying. There is meat stuck in your teeth. You are, they are, we all are, bloody-minded and beautiful. Daring to seize happiness during our brief allotted hours in the rough world, red in tooth and claw, sure. But also, first and foremost, don't forget it, nested and sheltered by the great whispering singing trees whose roots reach down past the glittering black underground dragon river to the earth's hot core, their branches throbbing with the sweet sap of generations sweeping us skyward. Such a wonder to see them eat light to make chlorophyll for us all. They are literally holding up the blue air whose love we breathe every minute in and out, out. And before we turned bloody-minded, we were rocked and held, don't forget it, swaddled in our mother's singing womb, held in her hot arms. Don't you remember? Deeply in sync with the great mother's planetary heartbeat. Can't you feel it now? The deep, slow thumb, thumb, thumb in the grass under your feet, in your blood. Here we all are, singing our individual and species parts in the great evolutionary cosmic song, sometimes violently dissonant in the paroxysms of jealousy and hunger and rage, and sometimes shining, shimmering, aglow with the galaxy's vibrations, the deep blue loving air, the tender solicitations of our extraordinary, unusual, magical, cosmic mother, Earth Mother, who clasps us to her singing, sighing, murmuring hills and curves. Despite our frequent inattentions and follies, our regretful and forgetful outrages and excesses against her, the great miracle being that in spite of everything, she still loves us, her recalcitrant human children, we who are gradually waking up, shaking off our drowsy, delusional, blood-spattered sleepwalk, remembering and beginning to cultivate once again our appointed, our inherent glory as emissaries, receptors, conductors, magnifiers, yes, magnificent incubators, dreaming brain wombs, carriers of the originary and coming light.
Thank you, Di. Well, that's an inspiring place to start. I'd like to welcome now Monica Kidd, who is a poet from Calgary. She's also a publisher and a hand letterpress user and a fantastic poet. And her new collection is called Chance Encounters with Wild Animals. Please welcome Monica Kidd.
Hello, Winnipeg. I'm really delighted to be here at Thin Air. I'm just really excited. Thanks for having me. Chance Encounters with Wild Animals is my fourth book of poetry. All the books that I've published have been published by Gaspereau Press in Kentville, Nova Scotia. And I keep saying one day they'll get sick of me, I'm sure, but they've been extremely good to me. I love working with them. They're a powerhouse of two people. And they really believe in the beauty of the written word. I'm going to read from Chance Encounters with Wild Animals, and I'm going to, there's several sections in the book, and I'm going to read from just one section called Meeting the Eyes of the World. And one of the things I do is, I used to be a seabird biologist in a previous life, and so occasionally I get to go to Antarctica and work as a naturalist on a ship. And this cycle of poems was written about my first trip there. And it starts with an epigraph from a British historian, Francis Spufford, who wrote, "You can't not try to read the great document of Antarctica for meaning." fly alongside these mountains that knuckle the continent. Amid a tangle of tattered flags, I watch the continent unfurl. Snow-capped calderas rising from the plains, a smear of umber and slate above the tree line. I have slept in these clothes, unburdened of my possessions. My skin cracks and splits as I slide toward the bottom of the earth. Revolution in the streets here. Naked, I slip between the sheets of 21 de Mayo and dream of her new tattoo. The black outlines of the lotus, luminous over the rise of her spine. Evidence of weather. Here at the end of the world, trees bend to the east, peg-legged by wind. Iron springs free from casings where piers crumble into the Strait of Magellan. Here in Neruda's country, old men gather like storm clouds, slap each other's shoulders over rounds of coffee, laughing loudly. Spanish makes my tongue lazy and my heart stretch long. Close the book. Begin again. A lot of people have read about the heroic age of exploration in Antarctica, or both poles, really, and it's really the same cast of characters. The same people who were trying to go to the North Pole were also trying to go to the South Pole, mostly white dudes. And there was one who really captured my imagination. He was French, and his name is Jules Dumont d'Urville. And I don't know why he really caught my attention. He was sort of a lesser character, a minor character in the heroic age of exploration. But he, the letters between him and his wife have been published. And she was writing desperately to get him to return from all of this foolishness, sailing around the world, because she was at home in France, and she had two boys, and one was dying of cholera. And she was writing to him to say, what are you doing out there? I need you at home. Your son is sick. And he stayed abroad. And their son died. And he reached a particular coast of Antarctica and found a very small penguin and named it after her. It's the Adélie penguin. And I used to think, buddy, you got to try a bit harder than that. But anyway, this is Jules Dumont d'Urville set sail. His teeth have fallen out again. In dreams, they move in his mouth, fall to pieces before he picks them from between his lips, sickening him. He says goodbye to his wife, his boys, to every blade of grass. The sun comes up over Tierra del Fuego, painting the walls an ominous shade of rose. Et ego in Antarcticus. This is a true story, just in case you want to look it up at Canada Post. Items prohibited from import to Chile. Absinthe, adulterated beverages and foodstuffs, chain letters, condensed milk, knives, except for cutlery, lottery tickets and advertising, offensive materials, pharmaceutical products and drugs of unknown composition, used tires. Just in case you're wondering. These are really about Antarctica. I'm getting there. He is held up at the 7-Eleven. A madman takes him by the neck, pushes him against the wall, stabs him in the ribs with his thumbs. In the pits of sleep, he finds his voice, calls for help. No one comes. Later, upon his release, he sits barefoot under a tree whose name he does not know. There are holes in his mouth. They do not bleed. Tierra del Fuego was home to the Yamana people, and the person The settler person who wrote the dictionary, the Yamana English Dictionary, was a guy named Thomas Bridges. And he was named Thomas Bridges. He himself was an orphan in London, and he was discovered by a man of the cloth under a bridge. And so he got the name Thomas Bridges because of where he was found. And eventually he became a missionary, went to Tierra del Fuego, and lived with a Yamana. And so there's a couple of poems about the Yamana people and about Thomas Bridges. And the Fuegians, the people of Tierra del Fuego, were in history portrayed as monsters and very, very tall people and very savage people. And a friend of mine who I worked with on the ship is an anthropologist who has worked with the Yamana people for 30 years. And he told me a story about going to Europe to look at the original glass slides that were used to produce the photographs that sort of went into wide circulation. And if you look at the original glass negatives of these images, you see what's been cropped out. And you see men and women and children with very angry faces, but in the glass negatives, what's been cropped out is that many of them are held at gunpoint. I'd be looking pretty angry too if someone was holding me at gunpoint. It's called the first one is called The Origin of Shame, Part One. Men stand with guns in the margins of the negatives. Thus, their stiff faces, stiff stances, angry faces, hands in front of penis. A bounty on their ears and out paddled by steamboats, they fled carrying fire, naked as the day God dreamt them. The Origin of Shame, Part Two. I nearly stepped on him. Poor boy sat, arms wrapping his knees, black eyes burning, quiet as a snake. Heaven knows why I had the biscuits in my hand, opened the tin and held it to him, shook it a little under his nose. Nothing. When I made to close the lid, he snatched it from me, ate the biscuits by twos and threes, bothering them down to crumbs he jabbed at with spittled fingers. Now, Bruce told me he was going to give me a stern look when I was getting close to my time, but I can't actually see him. 5 minutes left. Okay, I'll read you a few more. It's a long night. There's many amazing poets you need to listen to, so I don't want to exhaust you. Part of my life is that I'm a family physician and I deliver babies, and I met a woman on the ship the first time I was there who was a midwife, and she and I had a grand time together. I loved her dearly. Her name was Jane, and this poem is for her. Jane at Capillas de la Maris. Stages of the cross and legions of dead shaking us, silk flowers and Bibles in the tongues of the sea. Whale so close we hear him moaning, spine slipping to tail in falling light. Jane is here, white hair streaming and arms stretched wide against the wind, blue eyes tearing with the momentum of things, people the way they die or fail to wonder. Jane, who caught babies in the war, hold on, Mama, put your knees like so, look me in the eyes. Jane is here, standing on this ship with her thin bones beaming into the sky. It's a funny life that brought me to you. Sea gone smooth, something rumbles below. One of the jobs is to help people land, get off the boat, and go through penguin colonies without stepping on the penguins. And one of the places we go is a refueling stop for the British Antarctic Survey. And it was literally a little plywood hut. It used to be two people would live there, men, so they manned it. And there's a topo map on the wall, and somebody very ironically has scribbled Damoy Winter Sport Resort Hotel on it. So this poem is about that. Ice scissored blue organza sky. There is death here and also light. Ovaltine on the Primus, books, shelves, a string across a bunk to dry one's socks. Decorum. Small windows and things of the day, a bench for a cup of coffee, news crackling on the shortwave. We are two men watching the skies amid the honking stench, thunderclaps of ice. I have three little kids, and so leaving for a month to go to the end of the world brings some feelings, one might say, mostly of guilt. And so the other people who were parents leaving small kids behind on the ship, we would talk at great length about how wonderful it was that we got to do this and how terrible we were as humans for leaving our children behind. And this poem is about that. It's called The Quality of the Absence. To stand amid rank squalor under chrome-colored sky, ice collapsing, kettle hissing, the brutal truth on these plywood days is that one must matter more. I dreamt I was leaving, that my windows were smashed and I was surrounded by strangers. We gesticulate in Spanish, there is something he needs to say. Rain falls, brings me home. I ache for what's left. If you've ever been to a penguin colony, you know that they're clever little creatures and survivors, but man, they don't smell very good. And this poem is about that. It's called Natural Selection. One forgets they are birds clad in their filthy tuxedos, punch drunk and dragged through the muck to the children, threadbare, begging. The stench steeped into the boards enough to raise the bile. One of the places I've been to a few times is a place called Deception Island, which is an active volcano, and the caldera, the center of the volcano, has sunken, so the sea has flooded into the caldera, so you actually sail into the caldera of an active volcano. Last erupted in the 1960s, but there's still seismic activity, and as a result, they're at low tide. You can see steam rising from the Southern Ocean, which is usually quite frigid. And so you sail in through a very narrow gap called Neptune's Bellows, and you see steam rising in this volcano, and it's very, very striking. And so this poem is called Deception, and it starts with an epigraph from Theocritus. Next, with pure sulfur, purge the home. It also smells like sulfur. This mantle of black debris of whale bones and sailors, broken windows, iron stays, of potsherds, silence. The shell of a stove in a room open to the wind, blistered paint, sulfurous breath at low tide that scrubs this house of death.
I think I'm being signaled to stop talking. So I'm going to just read a very tiny poem at the end called
I Am Full of the Sea. I am come to land, bereaved of the stillness in my wandering bones. Thank you very much.
That's Monica Kidd. Like, have you cloned yourself, or how do you do all of these things? That's amazing. I don't think I've ever been in the company of someone who can, in a casual way, say, you know, deliver babies and, you know, don't step on the penguins. Wow. Okay, so if I'm coming back again, I actually want to be you. That's all right with you. The third voice in this first half is Jim Johnstone, who comes here from Toronto. He is this year's winner of the Prairie Fire Poetry Award, so he will be presented with the Bliss Carman ring at the end of his reading. But he's also recently published a really great book called The Chemical Life. Would you please welcome Jim Johnstone?
Good evening. So I'm going to start with a poem that I wrote for an occasion like this, and I think it's appropriately titled Performance Anxiety. I write, the tall grass is a third wish, then back away from the field. If I move back far enough, everyone in the front row will be still. Be still. You're witnessing my first time. A ballooning ballroom expanding until the beat drops. A letdown letting you down gently before the DJ jumps up, afraid to play something that could offend. I write, the tall grass is a third wish wasted, and pray for more wishes as the grasslands end. So I'm going to be reading primarily from my most recent book, The Chemical Life, tonight. This is a book that looks at anxiety, mental illness, and addiction. And several of the poems in the book are named after chemicals used to treat these disorders. So I'm going to read a couple of those. This first one is called Alprazolam, which is more commonly known as Xanax, which is a central nervous system depressant. And it's about my first experience taking the drug, which was quite transformative. It was a bit wild. This is called Alprazolam. My first time prone in the back seat of a car, skin horripilating as if it had been kissed and funneled away in a storm, aggregate of instinct and force under pressure native to a bomb. I try my muscles, try harnessing the current blunted by the road, the servant mastered by departure, opposite the new spine expanding from the blacktop's arc. Nothing. Around each bend, the continuum persists. False horizon, second skin, the meek inheriting the sins of the well-healed. What heals once the threat ahead has revealed its weaponry? My last stand, an inability to stand up, stand my ground. The roots hold less present the more time we spend together, bound by gravity alone. So this next poem is also a drug poem. It's called venlafaxine, which is the chemical name for the drug Effexor, which is an SSRI. And it's written about a summer I spent with a friend of mine who is also non-neurotypical, listening to records in a park in Toronto. Venlafaxine. The needle dropped out of habit, tongue interlocking with a tooth-cut groove. On Roncesville, before command reinforced our fear of shame, we'd circle Sororan Avenue Park like wolves loosed from the infirmary. The dame's rockets were armed with blossoms, and because we were free to fill in the field's texture, its grass and grain, I'd slide discs from poly sleeves as my brother cased the corner where moths lined the gates like lookouts beating through an unchanged city. Before the caps downed to keep us more us, the gates were peacock blue. The blues rerun, each note held where an ocean threatened to overthrow the stylus mid-song. Tidal flash flats diminishing our senses, our sense of self. Painted with a too small hand, you can see how brushstrokes overwhelm the mind, the cortex questioning, are we not? Are we not more than the first word or the last? Whoever set our interrogation to consciousness set it on the LP we mistook for landscape, set it with recurring strain, dizziness overwhelming the park's round. Curfew. Tonight, I'll move over shared ground. My mind free to feel, free will rippling out like shark gills. So it's really nice to be here in Winnipeg reading at Thin Air. My wife, Erica, and her family are from Manitoba. They live in Brandon. So I wanted to read a poem for her tonight. But this is a Toronto poem, and it's about an art installation near our home. And the installation is a set of eyes, these very, very large eyes under a bridge that look like they're watching you when you pass. They're made of stained glass, and They're really metaphors for eyes because they're made of circular objects. For example, some of the eyes are made of mirror balls. Others are made of the eye in a moth's wing. So this poem is called Spirits of the Grotto. Heels on gravel and further off a siren that hasn't lulled in hours. The underpass where streetlights circle like low-level drones. I pass the facade with my wife, the two of us alone with 30 sets of eyes, owl and avatar, moth wing and mirror ball, following an ambulance over Dufferin Gate Bridge. When its spell subsides, we come across a shoe, and the shoe fits. Our ghosts, a series of mistimed steps, the grotto scaled, foot by foot. So I always like to do a cover poem when I read. And a few years ago, I had the privilege of working with D.G. Jones on this book, which is The Essential D.G. Jones, which was released by Porcupine's Quill. We worked on it before he died. And he's one of my favorite Canadian poets. And I'm going to read you one of my absolute favorite poems. It's a metaphysical piece called The Perishing Bird. The mind is not its own place except in hell. It must adjust even when the place is known. Only time will tell the mind what to think, what birds to place on what boughs. The catbird crying, me, me, in a dry, hot bush. At night, the owl crying, who, in a distant wood. All else is an infernal shade, where the family trees gather their antique nightingales and the ill will flowers in the leaves. For hell's the Lord's bijouterie, a Byzantine world where the clockwork birds and the golden bees eternally repeat what the heart once felt, the mind conceived. For the mind in time is a perishing bird. It sings and is still. It comes and goes like the butterflies who visit the hill. The cries of the children come on the wind and are gone. The wild bees come and the clouds. And the mind is not a place at all, but a harmony of now. The necessary angel slapping flies in its own sweat. Cocking its head to the wind, it cries, who me? Who me? And whatever the answer, it forgets. It is radiant night where time begets the sun, the flowers, then a bozo's gift, mosquitoes who disturb my sleep, and everything else. So I'll do a couple more. This one is a little short rhyming piece, and it's about the internet, if I can find it here. It's called About Face. I can't tell a sliver from a seed. I can't tell a fever from its peak. I can't tell words from an attack. But I can tell you that you can't. I can't tell over from overuse. I can't tell no from an excuse. I can't tell timing from bad luck. But I can tell you that you can't. I can't tell flags from opera blood. I can't tell outrage from what the fuck. I can't tell forever to fall back. But I can tell you that you can't. And the last poem that I'm going to read is the Bliss Carman winning poem. This poem is written in parts. So I'm just going to pause between the parts, so bear with me. It's called Identity as an Infinity Mirror, and it was inspired by the Yayoi Kusama exhibit at the Art Gallery of Ontario that my wife and I went and visited. Kusama's infinity mirror boxes are, they really need to be stood in to be believed, I think. They're really beautiful. And so I start this poem with a quote from her that says, by translating hallucinations and fear of hallucinations into paintings, I've been trying to cure my disease. identity as an infinity mirror. Each body an entrance, each entrance a syllable repeating until variations appear. Here, here, and here, and here. The first cut is a curse, skin seamed and reseamed like the sleeve of a wedding dress. Canker, cancer. Uninterested in eye or the eye's interior. Uninterested in hallucinations, fear. Uninterested in circumspection. Uninterested in the held, holding, missing. Uninterested in another version. Uninterested in pride when pride is at hand. Uninterested in right. Uninterested in the element of surprise. Here and here and here and here and here and here. There are those who don't understand this condition, the something in we've all got to die of something. Thank you very much.
That's Jim Johnston. What a beautiful reading.
And now, who's going to come up from the Prairie Fire team for the presentation? Eric, can you put the lights up a little bit? So no one falls down the stairs, up the stairs, whatever.
Sounds great. Thanks. Good evening. I'm Sue Sorensen. I'm the president of the board of directors of Prairie Fire magazine. And thank you, Jim, for that. Jim is the winner of this year's Poetry Prize. Prairie Fire every year has a literary competition. And one particular special aspect of the Prairie Fire Poetry Competition is that the first prize winner gets a replica of this amazing ring, which Barb is going to present in a moment. It's a replica of a ring that the Canadian poet Bliss Carman had. And every year we make one unique replica, and it's awarded to the winner of the Prairie Fire Poetry Prize. Our partner in this is the Banff Center, and we're very grateful. And we are particularly pleased this year because the jeweler who crafted this year's ring is a Manitoba jeweler, Brian Johnson, so we're very grateful to him, as well as to Thin Air, of course, and to McNally Robinson. And now Barb Schott, our poetry editor at Prairie Fire, is going to present the ring to Jim.
So, Jim, your poem, Identity as an Infinity Mirror, hinges on that one little word, something. When I read your poem, my first reaction was, this poem is something else. Wow. On behalf of Prairie Fire, Andrus Taskins, Janine Chunky, and Lindsay Childs, the dedicated people who are Prairie Fire, it is an honor and a privilege to present you with the Bliss Carman ring. Congratulations. I feel like we're getting engaged.
Yeah. It fits.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. It's a wonderful poem.
Gorgeous. Thank you, Sue and Barb. It's a delight for us to be able to be part of a poetry celebration like this, and a big shout out to Prairie Fire, who does this great contest writing competition every year in all the genres, but that they take this special care of poetry and poets. It's pretty special. So a round of applause for them, please. And that is just half of the fun for tonight. So we're going to have a break now. You can come forward and talk to the poets. You can get them to sign copies of their books. We do have a door prize. So if you haven't been over yet to this fancy door prize draw box over there. Please put your ballot in. You could be taking home all five of these books. The other thing I'll mention is there's, for anyone who is carrying any stress in them, which is probably pretty much all of us, we are pretty darn thrilled this year to have a really great stress brain. With the big thanks to Taylor McCaffrey, and Kristen Whitman is here tonight. She's the president of the board of the Writers Festival, and I was saying to my board, wow, you know, we could all use a stress buster. And she said, gee, you know, maybe we could step in on that. So they have helped us by purchasing these crazy brains, and if you look at them, you can, like, ease out all the stresses of your life, which is handy, and it's, you know, cheap this way, much cheaper than long-term therapy. And you'll see that there's a kind of little right brain, left brain joke going on there. So help yourself. There's a whole bowl of brains over there. Who doesn't need another brain, right? So please come forward and have a drink, have a visit, buy some books, and we'll be back in 15 minutes or so. Thanks. One more round to our first half. Prize is Gabriele Codefana. Where are you? Yeah, exactly. You should win it. First half is pretty great. Second half's going to be pretty great. I'm glad you're all here. I forgot to mention before the break that we are running a 50-50 raffle as part of the Thin Air project this year. From the opening day until the end of Monday, the 30th. And it's online. So this is to encourage you to go to our website, thinairwinnipeg.ca, and click on the raffle button. And then the more tickets you buy... This is really cool math thing because I'm really working on my math. If you buy more tickets, then more money goes into the pot, which so when you win more. You see how that works? Okay. It's called math. I know. Math. Who needs it? So would you please spend all your money on our raffle? Well, wait, no. Spend most of your money on the books and the rest of your money on the raffle. And then... I don't know, come visit us for a new brain. Something like that. Okay, so the second half, we have three more amazing voices to bring into this pastiche of wordsmiths. The first one is a Winnipeg poet, Cam Scott, who is also published here by Arbiter Ring. His book is Roman Snowmare. Please welcome Cam Scott.
Have a little device here which will hopefully tell me the running time as I go, so no one needs to give me the stink eye. No, by all means, feel free. Actually, I can't really see anyway. This is delightful. This is my first time reading from a proper book object rather than fumbling with loose papers, and it's thanks to the superb ARP books. I am very excited about that. I'll say a word by way of preface. Roman Snowmare is a project that considerably exceeds this book. It originated as a gesture toward the sort of the modernist serial poem, the life poem, you know, a really large-scale work commensurate with the scale of a life. And I contribute a minimum of one sentence to it every day. So this is the first layer, or one part of this book comprises the first layer of this very large and at the same time very modest undertaking, because it was a way to get through a block, you know, to take all these little poem germs cluttering notebooks and kind of... transcribe them and call that the poem. This is the very first layer of Roman Snowmare. In the season of goose flesh and sweaters, every threshold is tested. For sleep, new insulation. For the windows, nearer panes. The campaign was an overlong conquest of lawns. The boulevards became our commons under threat of picturesque dissensus. Who pickets the impending day, straddles which neighborly barricade? The pancake batter looked like vomit, yesterday's intentions overturned into the sink. Only what kind of lunatic barfs on the dishes? One experience of poverty is to walk prodigiously, the distance to the laundromat, then back, clothes damp to dry them on the fence. Total savings in brain cells and cents, about a day's rent in the afterlife. This fall, one candidate relays our information to the market. I would he were aboard a wicker basket, smeared with tears and querying constituents for mercy on behalf of his successors. Sitting fireside, I'd knit him a flag. Who reads the news and isn't turning tricoteuse? Road rage is displaced class hatred, shaking steady hands. In the suburb I grew up around, sidewalks etched with swastikas, a plot of new cement was ready wet for propaganda. Above the fray, the people in glass houses can't use the bathroom at night. They are a lantern to the world, and we are moths to their good fortune. As art appreciates, the point of housing has become that everybody wants a home, but knows there simply aren't enough to go around. The sight of supper, a scarcely believable taunt. Certain menacing themes date the text. The headless sailors are less naked than a sign. A snarl coiled in the throat, awaiting winter, a wind-bitten competition. Earplugs have the pleasure. Whether angry, hungry, or nonplussed, each of them disapproved in their own fashion. A reaction formation to finish. Is your older sister yet a soldier? Does the memory remain when you repeat? As early in the evening as 7:30, my eyes seized on the direction of the grain. As though a current gripped my ankles, I would cross the room in long diagonals, staggering northeast or southwest exclusively. I couldn't reach the bathroom. We spent 3 days with my feelings and came home. The candidates are 2 smartphones with different chargers. A generation gap commends early adoption. Eyebrow solo, punctuation sweet. Plug awkward silence with a comment, more stopgap guffaw. I'm too effete to have a fate, and that too is a kind of theft. The coin collectors have a table in the mall on a revolving basis. That one could vote, if not strategically, then only on the maxim that one render unto Caesar what is his. So perhaps I won't say too much more about that poem, because as a poet, my vice is to mystify. But as a Marxist, my most boorish social behavior is to try to demystify everything. So this book walks a thin line. Whew. Thought I could dangle in the interval above the stair, below the street, held that our heat might keep in transit, or between 2 cities, separate lives, 2 beings represented in the moment of their knowing nonconformity to arbitrary fact. Reflexive chafe below lace tracery, umbilicus, our every kiss a costume, seamy seamlessness, flush feeling space may be contractible against all odds. Am I liberal in love? Define your terms. But if you haven't broken up with someone on a cell phone from a Whole Foods bathroom, you don't know the depth of bathos yet. That night, I took him in the mouth to White House. Are we so illiberal in lust? See how the sketchy overture cancels a common debt. Watch status structure the transgression. How Democrats debate the facts as if these strictures were debatable. Rather, ask what is to be as always. Ask what is, if imprecisely, to be done as lovers do. Am I too literal in politics, in love? the city's wakefulness, the glitzy sky obliquely allied to my farthest friends, who say with grave concern, where were you last night when we almost broke the record for the most pathetic reminiscence uttered sober in a dream of death? For 10 years frequenting the public record, proper denizen of airports, I would hear the escapees lament that nothing changes here while I was decomposing at their feet. Every vacancy is rumor, all is vapor, object permanence procured by sleight of words still relative to one's own fleetingness. To leave requires an axis, not a destination. Flesh can be a supple leash. To trip centripetal across the peopled plain, miss someone, say it to their face. Oh, wait, you can't. Write fan mail to said face. Forget to send it anyway. Your everyday and unremitting fog. Create the face which, in your recollection, comes more closely to resemble nemesis. And I'll change gears. Those were both layers from the title poem. And this is simultaneously the most, perhaps, lyrical and essayistic sequence in the book. It's called Voiceover, which is, I realize now, ironic because I've never read it out loud before. I still recall, strapped in the back seat of a car, eyes vaulting power lines, gliding along the slack wires, sending voltage town to town. Each time I blinked before a changing scenery, I'd call that takeaway a photograph, without a thought as to exactly where this irrecoverable archive would appear. I found comfort in my presumed ability to store surroundings on command, watching the fields pass as though already pictures. I seldom waded into these myself, happier counting threaded crosses through the treated glass of safety windows. I remember denim pockets on the seat back, stuffed with a day's distractions. Once it occurred to me that this was where the photos went. I am a lifelong passenger, riding beside someone or else behind them with affection. I like to fiddle with the radio, one way in which I am a child today, happily captive, and the best songs I associate with being led. Because of this passive relationship to transit, I'm still terrified of driving. Every time I get into a stranger's car, some part of me presumes an early death. This me that dreads to leave the city, even for an evening, is that same fanatical child who fears all lost when out of touch. Ironically, I am a stalling correspondent, for the city offers its consumer feedback in a there and gone game of immediacy that tends to the nearest horizon. It distracts. Eyes follow that unwavering line roadside, an illusory divisor of pictorial space. I'd stare into the cereal for swaying signs and come up empty-handed, glassy-eyed, so accuse me not the landscape of indifference to the real and route of our surroundings, any rootedness, reality itself. Depression is a day in which all grass is green. Elsewhere, the cities that I love enact a kind of horror vacui, bustle oblivious to void, an ornamental sprawl. That said, the city's seams are showing in the so-called countryside. Considering the psychic ravages of this arrangement, I plead prairie madness, transient affliction of ex-urban colonizers new to isolation, exiles of trickle-down convenience. Kid theorist of the nearest media, finding the depth of space already scored according to some metronomic rule, staves slackening outside the city limits, faces the window and awaits his cue. A cognitive percussionist whose cymbal makes a slapstick splash upon arrival, time to coincide with a liquid relief. The obvious analogy is with film. How distance is a question of succession and convertible to time as passage. Then what does matter's animacy have to say to creatural chronology, the vehicle in which we find ourselves already somewhere en route? What looms ahead of belted being, a ballooning airbag of an umwelt, panorama tempting fate? Suppose that every creativity endorses those conditions it cannot negate. A colony is not a problem of opinion, but perception. First impressions constantly refreshing a repressive preciosity. This makes poetry complicit, new words put to old associations, asking pangs of recognition to outstrip the space between different positions. No sentimental technicality can close the apperceptive rend of my own wake across the earth, a tourist from the first, though I remember sifting shared reality in interested fistfuls, feeling detail, grasping little and demanding names, a poetry of sort, if not of types, lost for a plot and knowing only lowly narrative. And I'll stop there.
That's Cam Scott. Thank you, Cam. That's the first time I've heard you read. That was really delightful. I look forward to much more. Our next guest is Kai Kallo, who is a Westerner now pretending to live in Montreal, or perhaps just deciding to escape the Wild West. His new book is called Magnetic Equator. It's a really spectacular thing. Please welcome Kai Kallo.
People arrived from Portugal. People arrived from Africa. People arrived from India. People arrived from England. People arrived from China. People predated arrival. People fled predation. People were arrayed. People populated. Whips patterned rays into people. People arose. People rayed outward to Toronto, London, Bu York. People raided people. People penned the past. People roved over on plains. People talked over people. People rented places. People planted people in people. People raided plantations. People prayed. People refried. People died and didn't get second glances. People won scholarships and vanished. People lived atop people. People represented people. People drain-brained. People studied for the common entrance. People paraded. People stumbled and tranced. People took two steps backward. People simmered and simmered and simmered and boiled. Over. People plantain. People orphan. People sugar cane. People undocumented. People underground. People never lauded. Landed. People arrived but people. People departed and arrived again. People retreaded. People stole knowing. People plantation. People horizon. People done run from people. People arrived not knowing their patterns. People arrived riven, alone in the world. People made their way from time. People hailed from climes. People fanned their spreading. People cleaved unto people. People writhed over, under people. People arrived over, under people. Asylum seekers have come from Syria, Eritrea, Sudan, Yemen, Iraq, and beyond. They arrive at Wroxham Road after crossing thousands of kilometers by bus, plane, and foot. CBC News, February 26, 2017. Nameless to the news, welcome. Amorphous file-seeking asylum, stragglers in the sun's eye, vanguard of the welcome exodus, wandering toward welcome in taxis, Roxham border, the crossing, gravel path slimming through snow and spruce, disembarking and walking north, rolling suitcases behind, welcome plastic wheels shuddering, gravel cracking, children on hips, welcome toys and shoes stuffed into shopping bags, family miscellany trundling, in this procession, crossing this warped sphere, desire, a trail of welcome that scatters back through darkness, exploding star liner, incandescence through which the equator walks its tightrope back. Solidarity Without Borders wants to mobilize the population to help migrants, and especially to send a collective message that they are welcome. Montreal Gazette, August 6th, 2017. Welcome plaited black hair. Welcome cocoa brown faces peering between sugar maple branches. Welcome baseball caps and red ski jackets clashing with the alternation of brown and green. Welcome amid jack pine trunks, black spruce needles pointing toward one welcome or another, one state or another, one constellation or another, illuminating every direction at once. Everywhere welcome, every place a possibility. Welcome every thought, a new sojourn, truth elusive. Every line branching and rebranching into every other welcome. Divining forward into hoarfrost. No indication of eventual welcome, rest or root, a temporal confusion. Is the future winter across the border or packed and shipped back to the welcome? Past, back to... She had been living in Fort Lauderdale since 2009, but left the United States last week because she feared being sent back to her home country. Montreal Gazette, August 7th, 2017. Welcome. Feared being sent, so instead fled. In this news, she is all of we, seeking, unsettled, unselved. They is welcome. She is all of we, seeking, unselved, unsettled. They is welcome, feared. She turning inside they self, turning she they self in, crossing into the feared being sent, so instead welcome, crossing into the arms of the buzz, turning inside they self, cut border officer in the southern Quebec, arriving at the booted foot of the state, at the mercy, imagine, at the mercy, imagine, for they who have crossed, they who have welcome, crossed a hemisphere, an imagination that has known only a backyard, a fence, a street, a town the size of a leaf, must dream for them. Welcome. A two-day bus ride to the northern border where the family crossed into Canada, suitcases in hand. CBC News, September 13th, 2017. Welcome, turning selves in, selves traveling through space, turning being into paper, flesh become white fiber for deliberation, legality in question, self a question mark, welcome signatures, boxes checked on forms, welcome dossiers, deconstructed sequences of numbers queued up to be filed, sorted, detained, cataloged, welcome, interrogated, archived, speculated upon in the news, counted, and either welcome, accepted, rejected, recounted, queued up again, filed into a different queue, chased, fled, welcome, or stalked in limbo in Borgesian bureaucratic labyrinths, trash-talked by pundits, welcome, whispered about in polite living rooms, opined on from the middle class on down, welcome, debated in wood-paneled parliament, encircled by welcome, by words invoked to stoke fear, vilified as terror, as other, welcome, now tossing on narrow army cots, chrome and canvas reality, minimal without aesthetic, the furniture of state aid, of news flash. In the first 6 months of 2017, officials noticed almost 4,500 illegal border crossings across Canada. 3,350 such crossings were made in Quebec. CTV News, August 2nd, 2017. Welcome from Haiti after the earth liquefied. Migratory aftershocks spread through New York, Miami, Houston, Chattanooga, New York for a decade. Welcome, working undocumented, and now Montreal, living in flight, temporary as rent, as graffiti, as the Turcotte L crumbling into St. Henry. Structural adjustment, welcome. Temporary and in-flight, welcome. To the entrance near the loading docks, the bleachers standing exposed to the wind, your collective living room. Welcome the entire concrete east end of Montreal, your barren yard. Between 100 and 450 cots have been set up in the Olympic Stadium. The asylum seekers will be housed in the area, with concession stands just on the border of the actual arena. It's a windowless concrete hallway. CBC News, August 2nd, 2017. Welcome the generations. Carried in your heads. Welcome the generations. Welcome the ghost cargo. Thank you.
That's Kai Kallo. What a spectacular reading, Kai. Woo. Take a second. Thank you. That was amazing. Do you like parties and stuff? It's not that far between Montreal and here. You think we should have him back? Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. Our final reader this evening is the Poet Laureate of Ottawa, so we're bookending our evening with Poets Laureate. Deanna Young has written a really powerful new book called Reunion. Please welcome Deanna Young.
Thank you. It's such a thrill to be here in Winnipeg, so thank you for having me at the festival. I have to leave tomorrow, unfortunately, but I promised myself the next time I come back, I'm staying for a few days. It's a beautiful city. Charlene, I feel like you orchestrated this really well, because having Kai, that phenomenal reading you just did, is ringing in my mind as I introduce my book. Rather than try to describe it to you, I have two epigraphs at the beginning of the book, and I'm just going to read those. And the first one, really, your reading just really resonates with me, because mine is coming from the same and strangely different territory. So this is from Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, and I begin the book: "My tongue, every atom of my blood, formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents, born here from parents the same and their parents the same." And then the other epigraph is from the American songwriter and musician Lucinda Williams. "We were blessed by the forlorn, forsaken, and abused." Ghost prayer. Let the ghosts greet you. Go to the crossroads and wait till you hear the ruffled breath of their horses. They are coming because they know you're there. Welcome them as you would your young self, long lost. Like breezes, let them in. Stand in the open doorways to catch their empty sleeves as they pass from room to room. They've seen enough to know it won't be easy. Love and mercy. Mercy and love. Let them speak first, and with your living body, listen. Well, turns out when you invoke ghosts, sometimes they come. And so this poem is one of those ghosts. It's called Tiny. When I was born, they wrapped me in a towel and set me in a roaster in the oven. It was just warm, and they left the door open. It was that cold in the house, and I was that small. Gertrude, my mother called me, but Tiny stuck. It suited me well till the weight came on around 13. And wouldn't I end up big as a house? Best day of my life was marrying Glenn. Get me out of this place, I told him, with my brothers all fighting for food like rats and my sisters hissing like snakes. Glenn built us a home with his own two hands, and the babies started coming. I always liked D's, so I named them Debbie, David, Denise, Darren, Daryl. The last one I lost, I would have called Dean. Sure, the house was full of cracks and the floors weren't level. Glenn got what he could from the dump for free, and the rest he found on the street. From the road at night, when the lights were on, you could tell where the wall joints didn't quite meet. And that time in the storm, when the village went dark and you came with your dad and sisters to sleep because we had the stove for heat, your poor mother stuck at the deboning plant in St. Mary's, and I gave you a drink of our stinky well water and told you, don't worry, it's safe. I thought, such a scared little thing. I knew your dad was as bad as they come. But what could I do? He was my brother. At the heart of this book is a cri de coeur. It's called The Lamp, and the lamp works figuratively here. What when resurrection doesn't happen, when the blown flame sputters and dies? Who will carry the lamp then, cold and useless? Why did it ever burn? Why was it lit? There are the living and the departed, the held ones and the discarded. And there, the shadows who drift among us, how will we embrace them now? Luckless, faultless, on earth forsaken, lifted from their cradles, shaken, the lamps that could not burn again. What of them? What light in that darkness? There's one found poem in this book, which I'm going to read. And I haven't written a lot of found poems. I was sort of researching them a bit and learned that there are treated found poems, so text you find somewhere and manipulate it in some way or treat it in some way and make a poem out of it. And then there are untreated found poems, so text you find somewhere and you just lay it down because it is a poem already. This one begins with an epigraph, and I'll just read it out and see if you know who wrote these lines, just shout it out. The epigraph is, I love thee, Wilma, with hair like silk, lips like cherries, skin like milk, your shell-like ears, your dainty hands, and eyes so black like frying pans. Yeah, okay, Fred Flintstone, so those of you of a certain generation will know that poem. So this poem is the found poem, and it's actually part of the transcript of my parents' divorce proceedings. Turns out you can get these things. Public record. All you got to do is ask. This is called And Eyes So Black. Now let's go on to this breaking of the ribs. Would you describe that incident to me, what led up to this? Well, he'd come home from out drinking, and I was, when was this, first of all? Probably about 5 years ago, 1972. Go on. He'd been out drinking, and when he came home, I just asked him where he'd been. I thought it was my place to ask him where he'd been, and he said it was none of my goddamn business. And so I don't know what happened. Prior to that, we probably had a bit of an argument, and he knocked me down and broke my ribs. You had a bit of an argument, probably had a bit of an argument, or you did? Verbal argument, yes. Did you ever hit your husband on the head with a frying pan? No. Did you ever hit your husband with a frying pan? No. I've hit him with a broom. I've hit him with a broom. Some of the voices in this book came to me as songs, sort of just short lyrics. And this one is called What Voice? What holds me stiff in fright? What shakes me? What takes me by the shoulders and warns, don't tell? In a whisper, what makes me? What steers me to the cellar door where none will find me? What calls from across the field with lies of my young son and daughters? With its hooked finger, what draws me like a sheep towards a slick hole? What breaks my leg, my spirit, and leaves me to suffer? What voice stands over me in the trap of night? The Holy Bottle. Young John Young was a mean old dad. He sucked raw eggs and his feet smelled bad. He kissed the bottle and he cussed his wife and never said boo when he wrecked our life. Last night, this one is called Visit 4 a.m. Last night my father showed up in my dream. I knew him by his back and wide shoulders, his head of curly black hair none of us inherited. We were doing this dance, he and I, among rooms that were all connected, in a circle, him unwilling to face me and me indignant. My son was at the table doing homework. My father would stop his roaming to peer over the boy's shoulder and then move on. I kept watch from behind the glass of my dream. He knew I was there. My son bent over his work, unaware of the ghost. I did not believe he was in any danger. I watched only for any sign of love for the boy who looks so much like me at 8. I don't think I'll see him again. My father rarely spoke to me, never met my eyes if he could help it. He never touched me either. I just want to make that perfectly clear. Not after the time he lifted me from my crib and threw me at the wall like a cat, as a brutalized man does a cat. My young mother, who had until recently never known violence, rushing in, blood vessels bursting around her eyes, a kitchen knife, the ensuing scene. Sometimes in writing this book, the ghosts subsided, and my own voice just came out. So I'm going to finish with a poem from near the end of the book that is is my own voice. It's called Lamb. The voices were small, insistent, and infinitely patient. In the years following Rilke's abrupt instruction, you must change your life. I did not want to disrupt my life. I called in sick. I washed the dishes scattered across the countertop like bewildered migrants. I wiped the countertop and stood back. I went into the basement and took a piece of lamb, the flesh of an animal that had been born for slaughter, a portion of its body wrapped in brown paper and held for months in a freezer. I took it with a vow to make soup. His words at my heels as usual. For here there is no place that does not see you. Cradling the package, I ascended the wooden steps and left it to thaw on the clean countertop. In the living room, I picked up a book. Not Rilke this time, but one of the others wandering in that camp of hallowed spirits, and flopped down on the couch. The first poem said, change your life in its way. The second said, change your life, and so on. To leave the lover and still have him. To leave the children and still be their mother daily. The answer did not come. It would not come forth willingly, I saw, like a wild horse or a beaten dog. It would not step forward until I showed it my empty hands. First, I would have to drop what was in my hands. Then only if I stood absolutely still and offered my palm slowly to its wet nose, might it incline its head. I thought of the lamb, in its death still something. Its power over me, how sacred my duty. As I lay there on the couch, I bargained feebly, weighing each thing I thought I loved against the ache. Thank you.
That's Deanna Young. Devastating and inspiring. Thank you. I think we have heard six brilliant and stunning voices this evening. Will you like to join me in thanking all of our poets? And now I invite you to come forward and have a chat with these three and the folks from the first half. Spend some time together, buy some more books, have a look at this rather gorgeous book bag that we have this year with all the writers' names on it. We're pretty proud of that. I think we might be getting kind of low on brains, but then who's not? And I hope you will join us tomorrow. We'll be at the library at 12:15, at the bookstore at 2:30, back at the library at 4:30, back here at 7:30. We've also got things happening across the river in St. Boniface and things happening at campuses and things happening outside the city, and we're busy. So get a little purple book and feel excited with us, if you will. A huge thanks to you for joining us tonight. The magic of poetry can't really happen until the circuit is complete. So thank you for being such a lively and engaged audience, too. Bravo to you. Come on forward.